Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. In part one, we introduced our guest, Dr. Ben Lynch, who's an expert on a subject that really needs to be brought to the attention of the medical profession, health practitioners, and the public, which is MTHFR. MTHFR refers to a series of glitches in the biochemical machinery that change the way that people metabolize common vitamins, and it may have tremendous impact on health outcomes, and it may be the key that unravels the puzzle of a lot of complex and refractory diseases. So our guest, Ben Lynch, is with us. Ben, what's the relationship between MTHFR and homocysteine? You know, until recently, we just used to routinely check people for homocysteine until cardiologists told us, oh, don't even bother doing that because we're not sure it really makes a difference in terms of heart disease outcomes. Was that a rush to judgment?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, you can research something and you can have the statistics. You can bend them any way you want. You can also do studies and have a population that, you know, contributes towards certain markers that are significant and some others that are not. You can also have research done, you know, and there's a bunch of compounding factors that mess with things. I mean, maybe the lab wasn't right. Maybe the nutrients were right and so on. So there's inherently a huge problem in research, and a lot of research is poorly done, unfortunately, but a lot of research is also excellently, you know, very well done. But I would say that the research that looks at homocysteine and says that there is no link to cardiovascular diseases is absolutely ridiculous. But I will say that if they do this and they find that, you know, they do it again and they good populations of excellent study and they see that homocysteine levels are, you know, let's say, you know, less than a 10 for everybody. And I think first problem, I think the normal levels for homocysteine are too high.
Okay. What should
they
be?
That's problem one. So it's easy to say that homocysteine levels are within normal limits of less than 15. And I think less than 15 is too high. And this less than 15 came from the standard population, mm-hmm. right? The standard, quote unquote, healthy population. We don't know what they're eating. We don't know if they're supplementing with folic acid. We don't know what it is. And I don't remember the last time this was adjusted. Mm-hmm. And was B12 identified, you know, deficiency is identified and so on. So less than 15 is too high.
Well, let's remind our listeners that the reason we're discussing homocysteine is because homocysteine is thought to be a disorder that is addressed with B12, folic acid, B6, and other nutrients. And we can actually manipulate this number. We can get it down with nutritional therapy. The problem has been when cardiologists looked at people with heart disease and did an experiment of some years' duration, not enough years in my opinion, where they gave regular old B6 and B12 and folic acid to those people over a period of time. They used to say, if you have heart disease, take B vitamins. Now they've thrown out that concept because that didn't reverse the heart disease of the people in that study.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Great
point. For a variety of reasons. You know, study was too short. People already have cardiovascular disease. We're not sure if it's reversible in a short period of time. And who knows, maybe the B6 and B12 and folic acid was not bioavailable, as we discussed in part one, because we need bioavailable forms of those nutrients.
Right. And you know, health is multifaceted. You can't reverse heart disease in all patients with just three nutrients. I mean, that's impossible.
Right.
I mean, a select group, yeah, if that's their problem, absolutely, if there's deficiencies there. But to answer, again, there's a couple questions in this statement, and one of them, one is should we throw out homocysteine with cardiovascular disease? No, but standard testing still tests homocysteine, which is fine, but the better marker nowadays is SAW, and SAW is S-adenosyl homocysteine. It's one step above homocysteine in the methionine cycle. And you're thinking, well, that's fine, but SAW is one form of homocysteine, and homocysteine is what they check. Why would you bother testing for SAW? Well, SAW is marker that, how do you explain this? Well, homocysteine and SAW flip-flop. They go back and forth, okay? And if homocysteine is, it shows that it's within normal range, let's say it's 10, it preferentially goes back to SAW. So you can miss people with methylation disorders or quote-unquote cardiovascular risk or high homocysteine. If their homocysteine levels are fine, their SAW levels are high. So SAW is the marker that you want, and there's tons of research on this.
Is that a generally available lab test?
No, it's not.
Specialty labs do it.
No, it's not. That's the problem.
Right.
So I just did a conference in Chicago where Dr. David Quigg of Doctors Data discussed this, and he pulled up a study that looked at normal homocysteine levels in patients with cardiovascular risk, and they also looked at the SAW levels. Well, their SAW levels were elevated. Their homocysteine was normal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in other words, it's sort of like another analogy might be, it's sort of the tip of the iceberg that you would see. The surface is the homocysteine. It might not look too menacing, but below that lurks a large chunk of SAW that might aggregate to quite a risk.
That's right. And then you've got downstream how homocysteine is utilized, and you know, that homocysteine gets converted into glutathione. There could be a various reasons why that doesn't work. Homocysteine gets recycled back into methionine. There could be reasons why that doesn't work. And the reason why it's connected to MTHFR, as you mentioned earlier, homocysteine works with methylfolate and methylcobalamin to convert homocysteine back into methionine. And what methionine is a protein that's found in basically all foods. So it's an amino acid. It's readily available in protein. So if you eat meat or any type of protein, and we need protein to survive, you're getting methionine. Methionine then goes down through a series of steps and becomes homocysteine. And then with the support of methylfolate and methylcobalamin, it comes back up into methionine. So it's this big wheel. It just goes round and round and round.
They even talk about what's called the methionine load test, where
that's right.
Once this was performed, they would give people 10 grams of methionine and basically see where that went, whether there was a response in the homocysteine, which I guess there could be if there's, you know, if the pathway is working. Or if there's even a blockade in the downstream metabolism of the homocysteine. So it's sort of a way of stress testing your homocysteine metabolism or your MTHFR pathways.
That's right. You know, and you see you need to be fasting if you take a methylation panel test. So because if you eat protein, then you're going to be boosting your homocysteine artificially. Well, not artificially, I mean naturally, but on a test, it could be too high. So you got to make sure that they're fasting overnight and take the blood draw in the morning for checking the homocysteine and ideally the SAW. But homocysteine is a good gross marker, but you need to use it in combination with a bunch of other nutrients. I mean, a bunch of other markers.
Well, it, you know, for our listeners, many of our listeners are saying, well, look, I'm looking just for a cookbook approach. You know, it's hard for me to get to testing. Is there a simple solution? And you can be straightforward with me if there's not. You know, should everybody start taking methylfolate and methylcobalamin you know, metabolically active B6, like something like P5P, to address some of these potential concerns, or is it more complicated? You really have to individualize the therapy and see a MTHFR literate doctor.
Well, you know, I would say most cases, I've forgotten what a typical patient is because mine got really, I don't see patients anymore. But when I did, mine were very, very sick and very, very complex. And I think the standard patient can get away with changing their diet and their lifestyle and their environment, those three things, and do really well. And if you need to supplement as well with the basics, you know, vitamin D and probiotic and healthy oils and a good multi, I think that's important. And I do think that everybody should eliminate the folic acid from their cupboards and from their supplement bottles. I mean, literally.
Well, that's going to have huge implications for the supplement industry. And actually, I brought it up at a meeting of not just a supplement company, but a company that sells a wide variety of nutritional supplements. They said, what are some of the trends in the supplement business? They said, this is coming down the pike. Check it out, because a lot of consumers and practitioners are going to become aware that folic acid has fallen into disfavor. And perhaps that's the same for some of these cut rate versions of B12, hydroxycobalamin.
Right. Yeah, and cyanocobalamin is the most
cyanocobalamin is the most cut rate. Then there's hydroxy, which is a little more metabolically active, but the one that's the most premium and most metabolically active, I guess, is the methylcobalamin.
Yeah, and methylcobalamin is very metabolically active. It's the ready form to go. And then there's another gene which takes the methylcobalamin and converts it to a mitochondrial form. The mitochondria would give your body energy and create energy, but it doesn't use methylcobalamin. It uses adenosylcobalamin. Mm-hmm. And so,
is that available as a supplement?
Yeah, it is available as a supplement. It's hard to find, but it is available. And people with chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, if they're taking methylcobalamin and finding improvement, but not entirely, I mean, there's multiple reasons for this, of course, but adenosylcobalamin might be a missing link, especially if they have this genetic defect. Now, I am a big proponent as well of more active forms of B6. As you said, pyridoxal-5-phosphate or P5P is really good, because B6 metabolism is also, I mean, that's a whole mess too. I mean, mm-hmm. You can see elevated B6 on tests, but it doesn't mean anything.
Yes, it usually is elevated in the patients who are on a decent diet and take a supplement.
That's right.
And then, what's interesting about that is I have many patients come to see me who said, my doctor told me to stop taking B6 because on my blood test my B6 is elevated. And they said, you're toxic, so you should stop taking vitamins.
That's right.
Right. That's very common. I hear that now.
Yeah, I see it all the time. All the time. And so when I have questions like this, I'll look at the biochemical pathways and I'll see, well, why are these things elevated? And then you start piecing them all together and it's like, aha. Well,
they're not elevated, just like a traffic jam. It is a traffic jam. There's a bottleneck somewhere, and that's why, you don't say, gee, there's just too many cars. There's a bottleneck.
That's right. That's right.
Right. So, look, I know you teach entire weekend seminars on this, and at the end people still say, we need more information. So we're not going to try to condense this into Reader's Digest form. But give me an idea of what a workup would look like for a patient who has some enigmatic syndrome. Say they have multiple chemical sensitivity, or they're suffering from a form of chronic fatigue syndrome, or perhaps an atypical depression that doesn't seem to respond to the usual healthy lifestyle measures. What are some of the tests that could be performed?
Yeah, great question. And I'll get into that after I get on my little soapbox here.
Please.
And when I was studying in med school, one of my professors said that, standard medicine now is about 80% testing and or scanning or some type of imaging, and 10% history and 10% physical. And that's flopped around. It needs to be 80% history and 10% labs and 10% physical. And I find history to be very, very important.
So treat the patient, don't treat the labs.
Absolutely, because labs, I mean, look at serum folate. Look at serum B12. I mean, you got to know what these people are putting in their mouths, what their histories are, what their timelines are. Did they move? Did they move into a new house, new construction? Did they recently get divorced? All these things are very critical. What do they do for a living? What are their hobbies? Are they using solvents? Did they just remodel? Are they in the car all the time in traffic, breathing carbon monoxide with their air intake on? So you've got to do a thorough history. And so you say you do an absolutely thorough history. Then you do a full dietary journal. You do a timeline of events. So basically from before the patient was even born, you were you breastfed? Were you formula fed? When was the first illness you had? What was done? What medicines, medications were given? What symptoms accrued from that? And so on. So you do this whole timeline of events, and then after you do that, then you say, okay, well, based on your history and physical exam that we've just done, it appears to me that we need to run these labs to further deduce what's going on. And what I would do for in this situation, you specified chronic fatigue, is I would do a digestive stool analysis. I would do a urinary amino acid. I'd do a urinary organic acid. I do a full CBC with chem panel and TSH, thyroid panels as well, full thyroid scan, on labs, not a thyroid scan.
Yes, the blood test.
Thyroid testing. And then I'd be looking at methylation profile, possibly.
Tell us about the methylation profile, because I think a lot of people are familiar with the standard panel, but the MTHFR test is actually to some extent a genetic test, although there are other tests that look at the sort of slice and dice the pathways. So what specifically the MTHFR workup, there's a gene test, and actually that's generally available through conventional labs. You can ask your conventional physician for an MTHFR test. It's just available through LabCorp or the major labs, correct?
Yeah, LabCorp, Quest, SpectraCell. Yeah, these are good. But the problem you have to keep in mind is if you go to your doctor and you order an MTHFR test through LabCorp or Quest, you have to make absolutely sure that it's going to be covered by insurance. Otherwise, you can get a $1,000, $1,600 bill plunked on your
bill.
Lap.
Yeah, okay.
And I have no affiliation, but SpectraCell Labs has a very good track record with all the physicians I've talked to in terms of getting reimbursed by insurance.
Incidentally, it's not a lab that is operating in New York State. New York State is very persnickety.
That's true.
And, it seems like none of the good tests, we can't get any of the good tests. If a test
that's
is
so
good,
weird.
If a test is good, there's some bureaucrat who's sitting in Albany who decides, nah, can't have that test.
That's
too
bizarre.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
Well, it's a highly regulated state. I could get into that. But, 49 out of 50 states, we can get certain lab tests. And we can get chemical profiles. You can find out if you're toxic with chemicals. But in New York, they've said, we don't want to unduly alarm our citizens because they're all toxic.
No, oh, goodness.
Yeah. And we would have a major outcry if people found out. So let's not even make that test available.
Yeah, interesting. And then another panel, which I missed for years, and it's not really a panel, but it depends on what's going on with the patient. But, screening for things like Helicobacter pylori is very important. And then other pathogens, Epstein-Barr, Hep C, Hep B, all these, mycoplasma, all these types of kind of quietly destructive pathogens that don't really cause huge harm from the surface, but over long term, they cause serious harm. You've got to identify those pathogens and eliminate them and rebuild the patient while you're doing that at the same time. So I would be looking and screening for various pathogens. And you asked about a methylation panel. Now, a methylation panel, a good one to me, will be looking at homocysteine. It'll be looking at glutathione. It'll be looking at various different types of folate in the blood, in the serum and in the red blood cell. It'll be looking at the SAM levels, S-adenosylmethionine. We'll be looking at SAW. We'll be looking at adenosine.
Which, by the way, is something that has its place in the field of orthomolecular psychiatry as a way of enhancing mood. So clearly that's playing into that pathway. And when people take SAM-E, they're actually stoking that pathway with a nutrient.
Yeah, and the 200-plus other significant genes. So it's SAM-E is a very powerful, very good nutrient. And for a lot of people, it's used in arthritis, pain, and so on too. But if you look at the pathways, you can see how B12 and folate and homocysteine work to make SAM-E naturally. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is responding well to SAM-E, it'd be interesting to see how well they would respond to methylfolate and methylcobalamin. And magnesium, because you need magnesium plus those nutrients and methionine to make your SAM-E. So magnesium, methylfolate, methylcobalamin, and methionine all work to make your SAMe in the body.
And these panels are, A, there's issues of availability, there's issues of expense, and there's also issues of familiarity of your practitioner with the right type of testing. And in addition, there are issues with interpretation of these tests, because sometimes we're just overwhelmed with reams of data and we don't even quite know what to do with it to understand the correct implications. And I think you would acknowledge that we're only beginning to realize the implications of certain test results.
Yeah, we're scratching the surface. And a great researcher, Jill James, and another one, Richard Deith, have really paved the way in terms of methylation for autism and Down syndrome kids and other conditions. And you can find a lot of their work in PubMed. And so I've read a lot of their papers. And the interpretation is very tricky. So I was just talking with a physician yesterday how important it is to, you know, how you go to the doctor and they order one test and you come back a couple of weeks later and order another one and a couple of weeks later another one, right?
Right.
It seems with this type of medicine and this type of practice, it's best to just go for it, get them all done at once. You lay them all out on the table and then you look at them and see how they interact with each other. Because if you order one test, you know, 1 week and another one another week, and the patient's symptoms are different, their diet is different, and so on, you're not going to be able to link these things together very well. Mm-hmm. But if you put all that biochemistry on your desk along with the pathways, and you can start putting together and say, aha, this links to that, that makes sense, this is why their homocysteine's high, this is why their folate's high, right? You can start putting all that together. And initially it seems overwhelming and daunting to the physician, and it will be in the beginning, but in the end they're going to get so good at it that it's going to be very quick. And when I was having my conferences and I would have a round table after the conference, there'd be about 12 physicians there and we'd go over cases that were just stumping these docs. So I'd lay all these tests out. It required testing and genetic testing and history, and everything would be written out. And I'd look through it literally in about 20 minutes. I'd give them so much information to go on, and it's just quick. And they're starting to get it now too. You know, they've gone to a few conferences. They keep hearing it. They re-listen, you know, ask questions, and they're applying it. And they're getting it. It's happening.
That's great. I don't think a discussion of this subject would be complete without commenting on the fact that the pharmaceutical industry is actually capitalizing on this. There are a couple of drugs out there. One is called Deplin, which is billed basically as Hamburger Helper for psychiatric meds for depression. It's designed to be used in conjunction with drugs like Lexapro, Prozac, Zoloft, and the like to enhance the benefits of these psychiatric drugs. And these, lo and behold, if you look at the active ingredient, it's methylfolate. And also there's a drug called Serifolin, sometimes combined with N-acetylcysteine, which is a precursor to glutathione. It's called Serifolin NAC. And that pharmaceutical prescription medication purports to help people with failing memories, headed for dementia, or with pre-Alzheimer's. But what's interesting, and I think you're very aware of this, is that the FDA has just issued guidelines for taking methylfolate, the stuff that really is the proper solution for many of these problems, off the over-the-counter market and making it a prescription medication. In effect, if you follow the money trail, they're protecting the patents of these drug companies that have invested a lot of money, effort, in getting approval for their meds. So what is the message to our listeners on that subject?
Well, it's a subject that we don't really know the full story on. I've read that whole FDA paper on that. I mean, I literally had it and I read through it. And they're talking about the naming of the folate and folic acid, because the FDA is finally waking up and understanding that folate and folic acid are not the same thing. And they want the label to be defined as such, which I agree with.
Right. That you makes know, sense. But yeah. If it were to lead to the elimination of folate products like methylfolate from the marketplace, that would be great to service to the public.
It would be. And I honestly, I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay,
I really
that's
don't.
Good. That's a relief to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have, you know, I'm not positive. You know, I'm not the FDA and I'm not a member of it. But I don't think that's going to happen. And I think part of the reason why is because these same companies who make these drugs, like Merck, Merck, they don't want these things taken out because Merck supplies a lot of the methylfolate that you find in supplements.
Okay.
So they have a lot of drug companies are waking up and
they're
saying,
diversifying,
you know,
their portfolio. They're saying, well, we can offer it as a prescription form, but by the way, there's a lot of money to be made in the over the counter supplement marketplace. So they're going to get you both ways.
When was the last time you heard of a great blockbusting drug on the market?
The pipeline's drying up.
That's right. The FDA restrictions are tighter. There's only so much, so many mechanisms that they can hit, and the consumers are tired of the side effects and the ineffectiveness of these meds, and you know they're not hitting these home runs, so they have to diversify their portfolio. They're losing on the meds, so they need to start investing in the supplement companies and the supplement nutrients, and they are big time. So I think,
but I think the fact that there are medications out there that are based on methylfolate for psychiatric conditions and neurological conditions illustrates the strength and the strong science base that this has. Really, these things have been proven to work. However, they're taking a simplistic approach. They're working with just one or two nutrients with the full palette that you use when you analyze the case properly.
That's right. It's very individualized. You know, you asked me earlier about, you know, basically a simple protocol for general people, or is it, you know, a full onslaught of individualized things? And it's kind of both. If you're generally healthy, there's a lot of simple things you can do, like avoid folic acid and take your B12 and your multi and so on. But then you get, if you get sick and you're sicker, your child has autism, you know, or Down syndrome, or not doing very well in school or mentally, then you need that full-on individualized approach and to really pinpoint things. And the other thing, too, is Deplin, that's 7.5 to 15 milligrams of methylfolate. I mean, we're not talking 400 micrograms, which is a typical RDA for 100% dosage of the standard person, 800 micrograms if you're pregnant, and 4 milligrams if you have recurrent miscarriage. And the minimum dose of Deplin is 7.5 milligrams.
Which is 7,500 micrograms. Usually we think of microgram doses of these nutrients. So that's a big whopping dose and may be suitable for some, but more is not necessarily better, as we've come to understand in biochemistry. So I wish we could go into a wide variety of areas here, but you've beautifully covered some of the most important areas. Maybe we'll invite you back on for a more complete discussion of some of these issues related to MTHFR. But folks, MTHFR is going to start appearing more and more in your lexicon because it's an important concept in nutritional medicine. And we wanted to broach that topic with one of the international experts on this subject, today's guest, Dr. Ben Lynch. And Dr. Lynch, what's the call to action for today's broadcast? Where can people access more resources?
Well, there's quite a few resources on mthfr.net, so www.mthfr.net. And you can get, there's free videos on there about MTHFR and thyroid dysfunction, folate metabolism, and so on. And there's some articles, there's a whole bunch of comments, there's a forum and so on. There's also a physician directory. So if physicians who have done some of my training, webinars or conferences are listed there, so you can find a doctor who's informed with this. I'm currently building an educational institute because I know doctors, they go to my conferences and they say, you know what, that was great, but it was like drinking from a fire hydrant. I got to be constantly updated with information. So I've built Seeking Health Educational Institute, which is seekinghealth.org.
Seekinghealth.org.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we do have, in addition to a lot of lay listeners and educated consumers, we have a lot of health practitioners who listen to these podcasts. So seekinghealth.org is a resource for more educational sources in relationship to this emerging and developing subject. So, I think I may be appearing at one of your webinars in the future because it's fascinating and it certainly offers a new avenue to help my patients. So I'm very, very interested.
Great. I'd be happy to have you there, Dr. Hoffman.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Ben Lynch, and MTHFR.net is a website that you can go to learn more about Dr. Lynch and his work. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.